Being 1 minute after 8:15, I call this meeting to order. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the minutes as presented.
Representative Seltzer moves that we approve the minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Chair Marquardt has a bill to introduce today. Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 630 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Members, I'm honored to be able to carry House File 630, and this is the governor's education finance bill. And I think what is really nice about the Governor Dayton's bill is that it really aligns with what we have set as a major goal for this committee, and that is to fund important efforts and strategies that have a proven track record of increasing student performance and closing the achievement gap. And if you look at the governor's budget, 25% of the dollars go to early childhood scholarships and all-day, everyday kindergarten, about $44 million into the early childhood and $40 million into all-day, everyday kindergarten. And as we have heard time and time again in this committee, that those type of strategies, those type of programs garner results. They, you talk about increased graduation rates, lowering the achievement gap, less incarceration rates, the benefits, come back to us several times over. Also, the governor places very important investments onto the formula, about $118 million into the next 2 years on the formula, and then also puts about $124, $25 million into trying to reduce the cross-subsidy on special education. Another really important area when you look at innovation and results and outcomes are the increasing of six regional centers of excellence. And not only will these areas help schools that need extra help, but also I see this as being kind of incubators of innovation and best practices and ways to really zero in on closing that achievement gap, which is really important. So does the author agree with all provisions in this bill? No. But this certainly, the governor's Dayton's bill certainly moves the state in the right direction towards a better overall workforce, a better economy, and is a great start, I believe, for this committee as we go to put together an omnibus bill that's going to benefit this entire state. So today I'm going to ask Dr. Melcher and Mr. McHenry from the Department of Education to go over the bill. My intent today is to get through the entire bill, Mr. Chairman. And so, members, if I could ask for just questions as they go through this, and I'm going to ask our presenters to talk about, for example, as they have in the past, as they've kind of given a quick overview of the bill, is what were areas that came out of the task force, and also the rationale, the governor's rationale on the changes that are in the bill. And so, members, if I could restrict your comments to actually questions, and then on Thursday, we don't meet tomorrow, of course, but on Thursday, then it's going to be open to public testimony and comments and anything else that the committee may want to do. So I'm trying to get through this today. Also, I know that new representative-elect Johnson has his swearing in at 9:30 today. And I think Representative-elect Thies is early this afternoon. So if
Thies,
all right. And so, and that's this afternoon. And so, if members have to go, we realize that, and so forth, as the day goes on. So, I think I've covered everything here. And so, again, I'm just going to be off to the side here. These experts will carry through on the bill. But again, I appreciate and look forward to working with Governor Dayton and his staff as we get our omnibus bill put together. So thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Appreciate Representative Marquardt carrying this bill for the governor, and appreciate you all taking the time to walk through the bill with us. As Representative Marquardt has laid out, there are several initiatives in here that are key to closing the achievement gap, increasing the graduation rate, and also increasing growth in our students as they move forward through their educational career. Just a few other things that were not mentioned. Obviously, we have some significant investments in early education. There's also investments in all-day K. There's investments in the teacher evaluation program. Last biennium, that was passed without funding, so we're beginning to fund the teacher evaluation program. There is a special ed paperwork reduction included. There's also the English learners expansion from 5 to 7 years because of the time it takes to actually learn the English language. So what we're planning on doing here is Dr. Melcher and I will go back and forth. I think Tom is going to cover more of the specifics as the formulaic changes in the bill, and I can cover some of the other options. But we'll just walk through the bill, and any questions you have, just please let us know.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I'm going to start walking through the bill with Article 1. The first four sections in Article 1 are kind of cross-references to other changes that are made a little bit later in the bill. Section 1 deals with an all-day kindergarten change that I'll describe in a moment, that this is addressed in Section 7 of Article 1. And Sections 2, 3, and 4 are relating to a change in pupil units, where the governor is recommending that we use adjusted pupil units, which are essentially students served rather than resident students, in a number of calculations relating to referendums for consolidated districts. So the first significant change here is on page 4. Sections 5 and 6 are relating to the inflation adjustment that is made for non-public pupil aid and non-public transportation aid. You'll see on page 4, line 27, and page 5, line 27, there's an adjustment here where we are using the formula allowance minus $424 when we calculate these aids. And the purpose of this is to adjust for a change in the pupil accounting system. What this will do is guarantee that the non-public pupil aid and the non-public transportation aid will increase by the same 1% that the formula increases, and won't inadvertently receive an additional increase related to portions of the general education formula change that relate to a change in pupil unit weightings. That's later in the bill. Section 7 deals with early admission to kindergarten, and it would require that board-adopted early admissions policies be based on a comprehensive evaluation of the student's readiness for kindergarten. Current law simply requires that if a school district or a charter school wants to admit children early to kindergarten, they just have to have a board policy. And there are no criteria in law for what that board policy will be. And we do have a number of charter schools and school districts that have a board policy as simple as if the student's birthday is before December 1st, then they can be admitted early to kindergarten. And so there's no relationship currently to readiness for kindergarten. Our early childhood section has found that that has contributed to a number of children who are repeating kindergarten. In effect, the district or charter school has a planned program where students not ready for kindergarten are funded for 2 years. And the idea here is to tighten this up somewhat, require that there be some actual measurement of the student's readiness for kindergarten so that the state only pays for kindergarten once. This is a budget-saving item in the budget this year, and there's a reduction of $2.8 million for the biennium that is tied to this tightening up of the policy for early admission to kindergarten. Section 8 of Article 1 deals with pupil unit weightings, and this was a recommendation from the Education Finance Working Group. The idea here is to simplify pupil unit weightings, to use a 1.0 weight for students in grades 1 through 6, 1.2 for students in grades 7 through 12. For students in kindergarten who are not in an all-day, everyday program. The pupil unit weighting would be 0.55. So it's just a little more transparent, straightforward way of weighting students. Also included in the same section on page 7, line 4, is the governor's recommendation for optional all-day kindergarten funding. You'll see that if a student is enrolled in a all-day, everyday kindergarten program available free to all students in the schools, in the child's school, that the pupil unit weighting would be increased to 0.7 rather than the 0.55. And that would provide on the average about $908 more for each student who is enrolled in a free all-day, everyday kindergarten program. And that's about a $40 million factor in the governor's budget. The governor's budget recommendation assumes that with this additional incentive, it does not fully fund the cost of all-day kindergarten, but it does provide a significant incentive that the percentage of students who are in free all-day, everyday kindergarten will increase from about 54% right now to about 85% by 2015. What we've seen this past year is that the percentage of students in all-day, everyday kindergarten is growing at 5%. So we're seeing some growth anyway. This is intended or expected to accelerate the growth in terms of the percentage of students that are served in all-day, everyday kindergarten programs. Sections 9 and 10 of Article 1 are striking definitions of adjusted and resident marginal cost pupil units. Again, taking a recommendation from the Education Finance Working Group, the governor is recommending that the funding for declining enrollment be done through a separate, more transparent formula, an actual declining enrollment revenue calculation, rather than burying the funding for declining enrollment in a marginal cost pupil unit calculation. So right now, school districts with declining enrollment are counting 77% of the current year student count and 23% of last year, and so you're kind of generating phantom pupil units, additional pupil units that find their way through all of our different funding formulas. In the governor's recommendation, we would just simply be counting the current year students for most of our calculations, and then we have an upfront. You're going to get an additional amount based on your declining enrollment as a separate category. Section 11 is the definition of general education revenue, and what you'll see here in the new definition for 2015 and later is that the current categories for extended time and gifted and talented are eliminated. Extended time would be rolled into the compensatory formula. Gifted and talented would be rolled into the basic formula. And then you will also see new categories here for teacher development and evaluation revenue, for pension adjustment revenue, and for safe schools revenue. And I'll explain where those are when I get to the sections in a moment here. Section 12 of Article 1 is the general education formula. And the governor is recommending that a $52 increase, 1%, in fiscal year 2014. That's on page 8, line 31. And there is also an increase to $5,700 in 2015. The change from $5,276 to $5,700 is not an inflationary adjustment. That is simply to adjust for the lower pupil unit weightings and for some of the roll-ins that are being recommended by the governor. So the overall formula change is a 1% increase in fiscal year 14, and then the funding is flat in fiscal year 15, and the governor is recommending that the new money in fiscal 15 go into the increase in the special education formula, which indirectly provides, on the average, about $180 increase per student that benefits the general education program in that way. Section 13 of the bill is adjusting the small schools revenue formula for the change in pupil unit weightings. It does not increase or decrease the overall revenue for small schools. It's just to adjust for the pupil unit weighting change. Section 14 deals with declining enrollment revenue. So this is about a $10.5 million program. In most cases, people have no idea how much money we're funding for declining enrollment, but now we'll know exactly how much money we're putting into declining enrollment. And the way this would work is the declining enrollment funding would be 28% of the formula allowance multiplied by the difference between the current year's adjusted pupil units and the prior year. So it would just be a straightforward, separate line item. You'll be able to see exactly how much you're getting for declining enrollment. It's not intended to be an increase or a decrease. It's about the same amount of money we're spending right now. for declining enrollment, but it's just more straightforward to follow. And again, that's a recommendation from the task force. Section 15 is compensatory education funding, and you will see an adjustment here where we're using the formula allowance minus $132, and that is building in a 1% increase because compensatory revenue is tied to the general ed formula. When the general ed formula goes up 1%, you'd expect compensatory to go up 1%. And then there is also an increase in compensatory funding associated with the roll-in of extended time revenue, which adds about $75 million to compensatory, and then prorates that based on the current compensatory formula. That's on page 9, line 18. Then on section 16 and 17 of the bill, we are using, again, the formula allowance minus $424. That, again, is an adjustment for the change in pupil unit weightings. It's intended to keep the secondary sparsity and elementary sparsity funding where it's at currently, with the 1% increase that you would again expect because sparsity revenue is tied to the general education formula allowance. Then on section 18, there are further adjustments for the pupil unit weighting change. Again, these are keeping the total amount of operating capital revenue where it's at, but adjusting for the change in pupil unit weightings and the elimination of additional pupil units for extended time programs. Section 19 relates to the operating capital levy and is adjusting the equalizing factor again for the pupil unit weighting change. Section 20 in transportation sparsity is changing from the use of resident pupil units to student served. And again, this is a recommendation from the task force trying to eliminate as much as possible the use of resident pupil units, simplify the pupil accounting by using student served throughout the system. Section 21 is a technical adjustment to the transportation sparsity formula, again, for the change in the pupil unit systems. Section 22 is a significant change in the equity revenue. This is similar to a recommendation, not identical to a recommendation coming out of the working group. What it does is it simplifies the current equity formula, which currently has four parts. It makes it a two-part formula, and the first part here would be a sliding scale formula of up to $100 per pupil, depending on the size of the district's referendum. If a district has no referendum, they get $100 per pupil. If the referendum is more than $2,000 per pupil, they get nothing on the sliding scale, and then it's just a straight line in between. So if they have a $1,000 per pupil referendum, they get $50. Simple, straightforward sliding scale. In addition to that, there is a $56 flat allowance per pupil unit that goes to every district in the state. So what this changes in terms of the current equity formula, currently we exclude districts that don't have a referendum at all from having equity revenue. And the task force thought that didn't make much sense, that we're trying to help districts that don't have a referendum at all. And so this would then make them eligible for equity revenue, just like a district that has a $1 referendum, essentially. Also, right now we have separate equity formulas for the metro and rural area. This would make all districts have the same formula for equity revenue. Currently, we exclude Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth from part of the equity revenue. That would be eliminated. Again, one uniform formula applies to all districts statewide. Section 24 is adjusting the equalizing factor for the equity levy for the pupil unit weighting change. Section 25 is recalculating the transition revenue, which is a hold harmless, to guarantee that after all of the changes in this bill, every school district and charter school will be guaranteed to receive at least as much revenue as they receive or they would have received under current law in fiscal year 15. So it goes through and lists all of the current formulas and then all of the new formulas and says when we add up all these revenues, every district's going to get at least as much money as they would have received under current law. As a practical matter, nearly every district and charter school receives an increase under this bill. There are a couple of charter schools that are at a zero level because they have an extremely large extended time program, and with the elimination of extended time revenue, they lose several hundred dollars per student. Section 26 is the transition levy, adjusting the equalizing factor for the pupil unit weighting change. The same with Section 27, adjusting the QCOMP levy for the pupil unit weighting change. Section 28 is a new category of revenue called teacher development and evaluation revenue. This is a governor's recommendation that is putting about $10 million of new money into the system to partially fund the cost of teacher development and evaluation changes. It's $22 per pupil unit, per pupil enrolled in the prior October 1st for school districts that are not participating in the QCOMP program. In order to qualify for this revenue, a school board and the exclusive representative of the teachers must have reached a joint agreement under the teacher evaluation statute. And a charter school would also be eligible for revenue if it is not in QCOMP if they have implemented a process for development, evaluation, and peer review that is comparable to the type of school district process required under the teacher evaluation law. Section 29 is the pension adjustment revenue that is being recommended by the governor. Currently, we have a negative adjustment of about $31 million that relates to changes in employer contributions to pensions that goes back to 1997. Back in 1997, there had been a supplemental employer contribution rate for teachers' retirement that was eliminated in 1997 because the fund was solvent. And rather than having the school districts keep that money, the legislature since 1997 has had a negative adjustment that applies to most districts. It basically takes away the cost savings that districts incurred in 1997 because of that change in the employer contribution rate. Again, based on the working group recommendation, the governor has recommended eliminating that adjustment. It's based on old, outdated data. A lot has changed since 1997, so this would be then rolling that into the general education formula. However, there are some districts that have much smaller adjustments than others, a couple districts that don't have a negative adjustment because they weren't part of TRA back at that time. And so there is a hold harmless that says if your negative adjustment now is smaller than the average, there would be a positive adjustment now so that you don't have a loss of revenue compared to other districts. And so what we end up here is a positive revenue of $7 million for those districts that are being held harmless rather than a negative adjustment of $31 million that affects most districts in the state. Then on Section 30, you will see a new Safe Schools revenue component being added to general education. This is the same $30 per pupil levy that school districts have made for many years for Safe Schools, but it would now become part of the general education revenue. And all of the uses of revenue that you see beginning on page 16, line 23, those are identical to the current uses of Safe Schools revenue. So what's really changing here is we're changing the $30 allowance to $32 to adjust for the pupil weighting change. By making this part of general education revenue, charter schools will also qualify for this $30 per pupil. I think the idea is that we want to have safe charter schools as well as safe school districts. And also, charter schools are going to have some negative adjustments in the special education revenue area because later on in the bill, we'll be requiring them to share in part of the unfunded cost of special education. And so this is kind of cleaning up two issues. It makes them eligible for safe schools funding like school districts are, and then it also offsets a loss that they have in special education as we require them to pay for a little bit of the cost of special education. Section 31 deals with learning and development revenue. That is the class size reduction set aside that goes back to the Ventura era, and this is just adjusting that for the change in the pupil unit weightings, coming up with a straight dollar per ADM rather than a rate based on pupil unit weights. Section 32 is including the Safe Schools revenue in the definition of general education aid, and Section 33 is including the Safe Schools revenue in the list of set-asides that we have. So Safe Schools revenue While it will be in the general education program, must still be set aside and used for the same purposes that it's used for today. Section 34 is another recommendation from the Commissioner's Working Group on School Finance. And it, on page 18, line 24, it would increase from 5 to 15% the amount of compensatory revenue that school boards have discretion over. And so currently 95% of compensatory revenue must be spent at the site where it's generated. 5% school districts can use to target to sites that, have special achievement kinds of issues, achievement gaps, but that there's not always a one-to-one correlation between the poverty level in a school and the achievement issue. So this gives school boards flexibility with 15% of the money to target to those schools that need an additional boost to bring up the achievement. Section 35 deals with the referendum revenue, and again, based on the working group recommendation, the governor is recommending a change in the calculation of referendum revenue. So rather than being based on the number of resident students in the school district with an open enrollment transfer based on the state aid portion, this would change the referendum to be a rate per adjusted pupil unit, or based on the number of students served in the district. And we would convert all of the existing referendums by taking the actual money that school districts receive after the open enrollment adjustment and dividing it by the pupil unit served. So the school districts would receive exactly the same amount of money that they currently receive from the referendum, but it would be based on a more transparent, here's how much money you're getting per student served in the district. There would be a new cap, which is on line 20.22 of $1,845 per pupil unit. It's equivalent to the current cap, but just converted to the new pupil unit weightings. There would be a referendum aid guarantee, which is on page 23. So a school district would be guaranteed to receive at least the same amount of state aid on their referendum that they currently receive. Continuing on in the same section on page 24, you would see that for any new referendums that school districts went out for, the referendum ballot question would be based on the referendum revenue being requested per adjusted pupil unit. So there would be a little bit more close relationship between the number of students you were actually serving and the amount of referendum revenue that you were asking for. It just makes a little bit more direct connection between how much you're actually getting per kid and how many kids are benefiting from that revenue. Section 36 deals with the general education aid appropriation, and this is striking on page 26, lines 11 and 12, the language dealing with the early graduation achievement scholarship program and the early graduation military service award that were enacted in 2011. We currently have only 17 students participating in those two programs, and the governor is generating a small budget savings, $428,000, from elimination of those two programs. Section 37 is adjusting the lease levy for the change in pupil unit weights from $150 to $162. It's the same money that we currently have in that program. Section 38 is addressing the lease building levy, the additional lease building levy that applies to school districts that are in a desegregation program. And what this would do is specify that for Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Rochester, that they could continue to make these lease levies if they have a desegregation plan approved by the Department of Education, and the levy contributes to the district's implementation of its desegregation plan. And for other school districts that are participating in a desegregation program, it specifies that they could only make this additional lease levy if the facility being purchased was needed for an inter-district desegregation facility. So this does tighten up somewhat the historical use of this levy. Section 39 deals with the Safe Schools Levy, and what this is doing is striking language that relates to the $30 per pupil portion and retaining language that deals with the additional $10 per pupil levy for intermediate school district members. So the $30 per pupil portion is rolled into the general education program. The extra amount for intermediate district members would still be a categorical levy. The Section 40 deals with alternative attendance adjustments, and this is striking language relating to the referendum alternative attendance adjustment. It strikes obsolete language relating to special ed tuition. It does, on page 32, line 7, make the resident district responsible for 90% of unfunded special education cost, and the serving district would pick up about 10% of unfunded special education costs. This is a change from the current policy, which requires the resident district to pick up 100% of the unfunded cost of special education, and makes the delivery of special ed services for the non-resident district or charter school free to that district. And so we're asking for some cost sharing on the part of the serving district, and this again is a recommendation from the school finance task force. There is an exception provided to that 90-10 rule, and that is that intermediate districts and cooperatives and charter schools where more than 70% of the students have IEPs would be exempt, and they could continue to bill for 100% of their unfunded costs. Page 32, line 20 in this same section is dealing with the funding for extended time programs. What this is doing is guaranteeing that the Area Learning Center will still receive funding for extended time services that it provides, despite the elimination of the separate categorical revenue for extended time. It specifies that a school district or cooperative serving students in an extended time program shall receive general education aid equal to $4,430 times the learning year pupil units generated by the student, and then that would be an aid adjustment from the aid to the school district that claims the student for general education aid. That $4,430 is based on the current requirement in law that 90% of the money follows students to area learning centers, and also adjusts for the 4601 rate. So it's basically the 4601 adjusted for the 90% requirement that money follow the student and for the change in pupil weights. Section 41 is a technical adjustment to the charter school transportation calculations based on the change in pupil weights and the elimination of extended time pupil units. Section 42 is a technical change to the law that requires us to calculate the 95th and 5th percentiles, again to adjust for the elimination of obsolete language and the change in the pupil unit weighting system. Section 43 are the appropriations, and those are summarized in the tracking spreadsheet that your House fiscal staff have provided earlier. The repealer section of Article 1 is on page 36, and the repealer is again repealing the early scholarship, early graduation scholarships and military service awards beginning in 2014, and also repealing the extended time revenue, gifted and talented revenue, definitions for equity revenue, the old calculation of transition revenue, an old definition relating to referendum conversions. It eliminates the aid reduction for the pension adjustment, and those are all similar to working group recommendations. So that is a summary of Article 1, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. We've got a few questions from members here. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Melcher, for walking us through. Just one question for you. We're looking at a $52 increase per pupil, right, on the general ed formula. Did you look at the potential effects of sequestration and the impact that that would have and whether that washes the $52?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Woodward, we have not looked specifically. I believe that we're looking at about an 8 to 10% reduction in federal aid for school districts in the event of that reduction. But I have not actually done the math on how that we could certainly do that calculation. It would affect different school districts quite differently because the federal funding is mostly tied to special education and to Title I, so it ties pretty heavily to poverty. But we could certainly look on balance how much that would be.
Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a quick comment on that, you know, the last budget we had to come up with an additional $500 million to fill the gap that the feds had where they gave us a $500 million one-time payment, and then we had to fill that gap. So we certainly it's something we need to look at as we look at this budget as well, as any gaps we need to fill because the feds aren't fulfilling their commitment. So appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Melton.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one more point, and that is that if there was sequestration, one of the significant cuts would be in the special education area, and the governor has recommended $125 million. Increase there, which would be much larger than any reduction that we would see on in the special education area.
Representative Woodard, any further?
No, thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two questions. So one is a real broad question, and actually I would ask it of the other articles as well. But in Article 1, and by the way, I think it's a pretty well-constructed bill, and I think there's a good sound logic here of interconnecting parts here, trying to bring some stability to K-12 funding. And while I suspect that all of us will have certain quibbles with particular pieces, I think it's really important as we have that conversation that we understand that if you pull one leg out off of the stool, then the stool doesn't stand. And so I think whatever we do, Mr. Chair, in terms of making adjustment to the governor's logic here, that we remember there is a logic, and that whatever adjustment we make, we know we're going to have to put another leg in the stool, if you will. But I do have one broad question. Article 1 has several sections in it that have some pretty broad policy directives. And so obviously we have a finance committee and a policy committee, and I have the privilege of chairing the policy committee. Can we expect the policy language that's embedded in this bill to come forward in the policy bill from the governor that presumably will be referred to the policy committee?
Mr. McHenry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, that's a great question. The way this bill was constructed and the way the policy bill was constructed is any item that generated a fiscal cost was included in this bill, and any item that does not generate a cost is included in the policy bill. So we won't have the same language in the policy bill, but if this is something that you'd like to see in your committee, we're more than happy to participate in that.
Well, Representative Mariani? Well,
Mr. Chair, Mr. McHenry, there are pieces here that we're actually even currently looking at. In about an hour, we're going to have a discussion on the integration program. There's pretty extensive policy directives inside this finance bill on that, some of which overlaps the language of the bill before us this morning, and some that might be in conflict with that. And it should certainly be our approach here that we be as efficient and consistent as possible. I would hate to have to try to reconcile all this stuff in May when very few of our committee members are going to be around the table having that conversation. It'll just be a handful of us. And so I would encourage the department to certainly work with me and look through whatever language is in this bill that really ought to have a deep policy conversation, that we craft that language. Either that or Mr. Chair, I'm going to craft that language, and then we're going to wind up with two versions of policy in this committee, and I might make for some long evenings here. Let me just quickly ask on the safe school levy issue, and I had a good conversation with Representative Hertaus yesterday about this issue. I see that the governor is expanding the scope of the safe school levy use. Currently, my understanding in statute is that we actually have some prohibitive language barring the extension of safe school levy use for violence prevention efforts. And obviously, Representative Hertaus, I think Representative Woodard has a similar bill. A number of us, because of recent tragic events, are really interested in perhaps using this tool to provide violence prevention efforts, and I see that that's embedded strongly in the governor's bill. And I suspect, Mr. Chair, we'll come back to this at some point to talk more in detail, right, because we're just running through here, but is it the assessment of the department that the safe school, and I'm sure there's not a simple answer to this, but that the safe school revenue as it currently exists with this additional set of expectations will be sufficient to meet both those additional set of expectations and what we're currently using that levy for? I can tell you in my school district, the issue of providing police protection in some of our local schools is a cost prohibitive issue, and so I suspect we've got some potentially huge costs here. So the question is, you know, broadly again, you know, whether the assumption here is that the revenue that's generated here will be enough to cover both the existing and the new mandates, if you will, in the bill.
Mr. McHenry or Dr. Meltzer?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mariani, the new language that you see on pages 16 and 17 of the bill relating to uses of the Safe Schools levy is the same language that we have in current law, so there isn't an expansion of uses. We know that for many years we've had quite a long list of things that Safe Schools revenue can be used for, and we know that most school districts are using more than $30 per pupil unit to try to address those issues. But this bill itself, and Mr. McHenry may be able to answer if there are other things in the governor's recommendations that would expand the use, this language is just basically recodifying the existing uses of revenue in the general education statute rather than in a separate safe school statute.
Representative Mariani?
Well, Mr. Chair, we'll come back to this. I guess I'm a little confused because I did look at the recent statute and there was prohibitive language in the statute that this language seems to conflict with, but I don't know the statute as well as I should, so we'll come back to this issue.
Mr. McHenry?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, we're more than happy to continue working with you on that. We do have some language in this bill related to the Climate Center, and there's also some language in the Department of Public Safety budget to help address the issue.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, just to circle back to my opening comment, the Climate Center language is language that has a strong overlap with anti-bullying bills that are coming forward. Which will be vetted in another committee before it comes here too. So just sort of a case in point, you know, of our need to really be very efficient about how we tie our policy work with our finance work. And I know that's less the, Mr. Chair, I know that's less the executive branch's care, but it's certainly our care in the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Would any of the testifiers like to respond, or can we move on to other questions? Okay. Representative Breinert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either Dr. Meltzer or Mr. McHenry, when you spoke to the bill initially, you talked about the roll-in. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about the roll-in of extended time and gifted and talented. And one, I'd like you to speak to the rationale. And two, I'd like you to speak to the hold harmless in provisions in relation to alternative learning centers, because I see there are some financial caveats in relation to ALC funding. And I think these both have implications for us analyzing the appropriateness of the roll-ins.
Mr. McHenry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Breinert, thank you for the question. The overall goal on in putting this bill together was to provide flexibility to districts to best address the challenges that they may have. In addition, we'd have our oversight of the MMR to hold districts accountable In specifically looking at the roll-in of extended time, one of the things we looked at was is trying to get as much data on how they're performing or how any program is performing. What we found is really difficult. We don't have the data in this state to effectively show exactly how those programs are performing. Trying to isolate the sample size of the extended time is quite difficult. However, we have looked at some national studies, and what some national studies have shown, where they put in some specific, where they've done some specific work on this, is that they've shown that extended time is effective when it's directed towards students in poverty. And what we wanted to make sure as we were moving forward in this proposal was to make sure that the proposal provided some flexibility, but if we were providing the extra money, that we were actually directing it to the students who need it most. And we felt that by rolling that into compensatory, that would help achieve both the flexibility and directing it towards students in poverty.
Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think this is an item similar to others that Representative Mariani has mentioned that has some serious policy implications, so I won't belabor it now. But I think it's dubious to consider that by rolling the extended time revenue in, we'll be able to get better data on the students being served currently by ALC. So I think there's some data issues that need further analysis. And then policy pieces that need discussion. So thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, Dr. Melford. I'm looking at Section 20 and Section 22 to 23. As far as the operating levy referendum, I attended a superintendent's regional meeting a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things they brought out, and again, this is in the rural area, that the match from the state, and again, they showed a chart. I don't have it with me right now, but I think it was about 10 to 12 years ago. There was a 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 match. In other words, for every $1 of local levy on operating levy referendum, you had a $3 or $4 match from the state. Because there's been no inflation factor tied to that, that has changed. That's completely flipped around. Where there's about a dollar match from the state for every $3 or $4 of local levy, and the superintendent's position was that there's about a $331 million gap in funding for rural school districts versus the metro school districts, and they want that $331 million made up. And I said, well, if we were Washington, we could just print that for you, but the state of Minnesota, we got to try to balance our budget. My thought was to tie an inflation factor to that, which there isn't right now, to the operating referendum, so that you gradually close that gap over a period of time rather than continue to see it widen, especially for the rural school districts. Is there anything in the governor's budget that would address that, and do you have any other thoughts of how we might address that funding gap?
Dr. Melcher?
And Representative Grunhagen, the issue of referendum equalization and whether we should have an inflation adjustment tied to that was something that the School Finance Task Force looked at, and they did recommend an increase in referendum equalization and a link to inflation. There would have been a significant cost associated with that, and the governor, in putting together his budget, did not include that in these recommendations. So the level of referendum funding, referendum state aid here, is slightly higher than the current law, but that is to ensure that all districts will receive at least as much referendum equalization aid as they receive currently, given some of the changes we're making in the pupil unit weighting and the alternative attendance adjustments and so forth. But it does not provide that kind of overall increase in equalization aid to get us back to a level that we were at 10 or 15 years ago.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so basically, if we don't address that in terms of longer term, won't the gap just continue to widen? I know you talked about a short-term solution, but...
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, we do track annually the gap in funding associated with referendum revenues. It declined between 1993 and 2001. It's been getting worse since since 2001, and so we do annually report that to all of the school districts and to the legislature. But the focus in this budget was addressing some of the funding gaps that are tied to the special education area with that $125 million investment. We know there are very large funding gaps among districts in terms of the cross subsidies that they have to address, and I think the governor's priority was to try to address the special education cross subsidy. I think there was recognition that we do need to look at and consider referendum equalization as well, but the money just wasn't there to do both, and the governor's priority was on addressing the special ed cross subsidy.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, just on another topic, Dr. Meltzer. Thanks for that response. You know, I looked at the Office of Minnesota Management and Budget, and I think you'll be able to address this. And basically, personally, this goes as far as the funding of the government's proposal or the governor's proposal, education and the budget in general. But, you know, our personal income growth in the state of Minnesota in the last 5 years has been around 2.1 to 2.4%, okay? Yet, according to Minnesota Management and Budget, they're projecting in the future years, which the governor's budget's tied to, personal income growth of 4.4 to 4.3%. So they're basically doubling the personal income growth in the projected years, which obviously has a huge effect on the numbers for the budget. The question is that what the governor's budget is based on, the 4.3 to 4.4 projected growth of personal income? And if it's not there, that's going to change the numbers dramatically.
Dr. Meltzer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, the governor's budget is based on the November budget forecast, which I believe you had a discussion of the cost of government data in one of your earlier hearings, and I believe some of those numbers sound familiar to me. The 4% was one of the years, and so the governor's budget is based on the budget forecast, and that does reflect some assumption that there will be some recovery from our economic downturn. The Department of Education is not the experts on projecting income growth, certainly, but we rely on the Department of MMB and the work that they do with their consultants in terms of the forecast.
Representative Grunhagen?
Just a final comment. You know, I just think it'd be very interesting, and maybe this isn't the place to address it, to project the governor's budget at the optimistic rate, which it is at 4.4 to 4.3 projected growth of personal income, and then to do another analysis of what it currently is, the 2.4 to 2.3 percent analysis. I think we would see that if the rosy projections are wrong, the deficits are going to grow exponentially in the future if the personal income doesn't rise at the projected rate. Just food for thought.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And during this presentation on parts of 8 and 9, I heard removing phantom students, and that caught up to me a little bit when we were on page 20, you're talking about going to adjusted versus residential, and I have had several constituents say, well, so our taxes will go up to pay for, so we'll be paying for kids that don't live in the district. I know some districts with open enrollment, it helps counter a loss in students, so instead of the state paying for that decreasing enrollment, the residents will be paying higher taxes for the students that come in that don't live there. But I'm also am interested in the special ed. I like the 10%, 90% shift because that does allow a little bit of fiduciary from the district where the special ed is being provided. However, since the district sending is still paying 90%, they no longer get levy for the students that's a resident but attending somewhere else. I think that financial impact might be a little again, a little less fair. In other words, you take away money and give us a little bit back, and I think this needs to be looked at a little more closely, the ramifications in that interaction. And I did want to say that I also want to echo Representative Beinart and others who have said that ALC funding being rolled in is counterintuitive and not logical to more transparency, accountability, and tracking. So I wish that there'd be some reconsideration on that approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. We've got two more questions to get through. Could we get through them very briefly, members? And we've got about half or a little over half this bill to get through. So Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recognizing that this question is better asked offline, I'll be very, very brief. But Representative Gruenhagen kind of motivated me to ask the question. The question is this. The disparity, perceived or real, between the rural districts and other districts is growing and is a real problem, in particular in northeastern Minnesota. My question has to do with the collection of taconite taxes, which are in place of property taxes, which at the end of the day, as a percentage of the total tax, precious little is spent on public education in the districts and on the kids in the seven counties of the Taconite Assistance Area. The question is, could the infamous governing body that governs the use of those property tax dollars convert a portion of those dollars not currently going to the public school systems, could those dollars be diverted statutorily or by action of the board without a corresponding reduction in state dollars from the formula or any of the other funding streams that the state provides all school districts?
Dr. Melcher, Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anzout, the governor's budget doesn't make any changes in the taconite, at least not in the education bill. I know in the past there have been some provisions. I know there is a provision that allows school districts in the taconite area to use some of those dollars for referendum equalization or to generate more money from referendum. So that's something that I believe could be looked at. Certainly legislation could be changed that would adjust how that taconite referendum piece works. But it's not something we've looked at this year in our budget deliberations. We'd be happy to work with you or with House research staff on options.
Thank you.
And final question, brief if we can, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Melcher. Thank you for your presentation. You made some comments regarding the different sources of revenue and their calculations, and tragically, I look at this and feel like you need to be a Philadelphia lawyer to figure out all of the different sources of revenue that school districts are subjected to. But in your comment about the basic revenue, you increase, or the governor proposes to increase it by $52, and that was noted that increase was primarily due to increases, a 1% increase to compensate for the student pupil weighting. And you made reference in several occasions about to the change in pupil weighting. Could you comment briefly on how any of these changes really do anything to close the gap for the rural and greater Minnesota school districts and close the disparity between perhaps the Students for Equity in Education group in the AMSD school districts?
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Melcher,
Representative, I would say that the pupil unit weighting changes are intended to just make the system a little simpler to understand and more straightforward. So in this budget, in fiscal year 2015, the formula allowance is $5,700. Every student in grades one through six will actually get $5,700. So the formula allowance actually means something. It's an actual amount, where now the formula allowance is $5,224, but you got to multiply every single kid in the state by some other weight, and then you have to subtract off what we're taking away from them in pension. And so, you know, at the end of a page or two of calculations, you can figure out. So that part is not really about changing the distribution. It's just making things more straightforward. I would say that that one thing in this bill that does help in terms of low revenue districts is the change in equity revenue, which no longer excludes districts that have not passed a referendum from participating in the program. Now, many C districts do have referendums, but for those that do not have a referendum at all, this will make available to them equity revenue that they have not been able to participate in before. But I would say that overall, this budget package does not create any huge changes in terms of distribution of dollars targeted to low revenue districts. Again, the task force did look at a change that would roll $300 per student of referendum revenue into the basic formula and kind of level up in that way. And that was not one of the governor considered that very carefully, but it was not one of the things that he recommended in the final bill. And so what we're seeing here in the equity area is some movement in that direction, but we're not seeing a dramatic kind of change to narrow the funding gap among districts in this bill.
Thank you for that candid reply.
Representative Hertas, anything else?
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. McHenry.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, I just wanted to follow up on that. Obviously, there were a significant number of provisions included in the Ed Finance Task Force, and the governor did review those and did put forth some significant recommendations from the task force. Obviously, as Dr. Melcher indicated before, we are working under the November forecast and trying to move the needle forward. When you were talking just how we're moving the needle forward, we are open to any ideas. Obviously, I think the commissioner and the governor have said that this is a first step forward, and anybody that wants to bring forth good ideas, we are more than happy to hear that. But as far as trying to close the gap and to increase equity, there are provisions. We're expanding the early childhood scholarships. We're increasing the amount of students to all day K. We are providing funding for teacher evaluation that was not provided before. We're doing things such as expanding the regional centers, which can help districts in greater Minnesota as far as collaborating and providing best practices. And then also we're providing this new paperwork reduction for special education that could help districts save some money. So we're trying to provide some more flexibility so districts can operate and do what they feel is best for their students. And we're trying to be as helpful as possible in this budget.
Dr. Melcher, Mr. McHenry, let's jump right into Article 2 here. We're going to leave about 10 minutes for questioning at the end here, so pace yourselves appropriately.
Mr. Chair, members, in Article 2, Section 1 is dealing with regional centers of excellence. Right now, through the NCLB waiver, we have three regional centers of excellence. They work specifically with Title I schools who are identified as priority and focus schools. So those are the schools that are contributing the most to the achievement gap and that are some of our lowest performing schools. What this proposal would do, it expand the number of regional centers of excellence to nine. and it would also increase the districts they work with. They would no longer work specifically with just Title I schools that are priority and focus schools, but could work with all schools. And the idea behind this is it's an avenue to help provide shared best practices and evidence-based research best practices for districts and as much support as those centers can give. And that's going to be funded in FY14 at $1.5 million, and will gradually expand $3 million in FY15.
Section 2 of Article 2 are technical changes related to the elimination of marginal cost pupil units and striking of obsolete language. Section 3 is a change in the requirements for charter school building leases. It would require that a charter school must submit information on their leases, including modifications and renewals prior to the execution of the lease. Currently, the department is charged with review and approval of leases, but we review them after they've already been finalized and signed as contracts, so it prevents the department from making any helpful suggestions in terms of how the leases actually work. This would also require that the department not approve facility leases that do not have a some certain annual cost or that do not have an escape clause that can be exercised in the event that a charter school goes out of business due to non-renewal or termination of the charter school contract. Section 4 is adjusting the charter school general education calculations to reflect the changes that were made in Article 1. In addition to making charter schools eligible for safe schools revenue, charter schools would also receive equity revenue as if they were a school district. In other words, we would look at the amount of referendum revenue that a charter school receives through the open enrollment adjustment, and they would be on a kind of a sliding scale the same way that a school district is. Currently, charter schools simply receive the state average equity revenue per pupil. So this would bring about a little bit more equity in terms of allocation of equity revenue to charter schools. Transportation for charter schools is adjusted in Section 5. Section 6 deals with building lease aid, and again, there's a significant change in the policy as it relates to charter school lease aid. The change from 1,200 to 1,314 is simply to adjust for the pupil unit weighting change, but the significant change is on page 39, lines 30 and through 34, and this would reduce the amount of charter school lease aid for leases that where the original debt has been paid off, and in that situation, the expectation is that the cost of the lease should be a lot lower, and so the formula here would be $3 per square foot or $200 per pupil unit, and this is a $1.8 million budget savings in the governor's budget. Section 7 would strike language authorizing extended time pupil units related to programs that provide grade level acceleration. We've had a great deal of difficulty with these programs in terms of any documentation that additional time at elementary schools will result in students graduating before their peers many years later. Section 8 on the career and technical levy is allowing for a more equitable distribution of the levy between small rural districts that are cooperating. Currently, the school district that hires the career tech teacher makes all of the levy, even if they're jointly participating with another school district. This would say you can take that levy and split it between the two schools that are kind of working cooperatively rather than having one district do all of the levying. No net change, but just spreads the levy more fairly. Section 9 deals with the governor's recommendation on English learners being funded for 7 years rather than 5 years. Section 10 is adjusting the early English language learner formula for the change in marginal cost pupil units, so going from 700 to 705 because there are a few less pupil units. when you don't do the weighting. And then Section 11 is integration revenue, and Kevin, I think, wants to speak to the policy side of that.
And just going back on what Tom had, or Dr. Melcher had just said, that the expansion from 5 to 7 years for English learners was a recommendation from the Ed Finance Task Force. And the integration revenue change is similar to the Ed Finance Task Force. Right now, what districts have to do is they put forward a plan through statute, through approved uses that is approved through MDE for uses of integration revenue. What this plan would do is it would change it so districts could identify the goals that they have for closing the achievement gap and increasing interracial contact. And they put forward those goals. They make it public through their district, and they're held accountable through their district for how they will actually use those funds. After 3 years, that program and that plan would be reviewed to see what they did to actually reach those goals. So this was this was kind of the big change as far as the policy included and how that's linked to the funding, which Tom will get into. And we look forward to working with Representative Mariani and the policy committee and all of you on this language.
The recommendations for integration funding are on page 46, line 30, and then on page 47. The governor is recommending that for fiscal year 2014 that a new integration formula be established where the funding would be the lesser of the district's budget for integration or the greater of 90% of the integration revenue for fiscal 13 or a rate based on the a number of pupil units and the concentration of minority students in the district. So this is very similar to the working group recommendation. They recommended a 60% hold harmless. This would have a 90% hold harmless. It would create a kind of a sliding scale based on the concentration of minority students. So it would provide a significant increase for some of our suburban and rural districts that have seen large increases in the concentration of minority students over the years but have not been funded for those. It also adds an element on page 47, line 4, that builds in the focus rating as part of the calculation. So we now would have a performance-based piece that would drive a portion of the integration revenue. The focus rating is a part of the MMR measurement that looks at the success the district has had in closing achievement gaps. In fiscal year 15, the proposal is the same as fiscal year 14, but because the levy that's associated with integration revenue sunsets after fiscal year 14 under current law, the funding is scaled back by 30% to reflect the 30% share that's currently coming from the levy. Section 12 deals with literacy incentive aid, and the governor is recommending here that the beginning in fiscal year 15 that we make an adjustment that would build in some high school data as well as elementary school data in our performance measure. So currently all of the literacy incentive aid goes out based on third grade reading proficiency and growth in reading between third and fourth grade. What this would do is that would be to allocate about two-thirds of the money based on growth in reading between third and fourth grade. And about a third of the money would be allocated based on the school district's high school graduation rate in relation to the high school graduation that you would expect given the school's demographics. So what this would do would be to broaden literacy incentive aid to provide incentives for performance. At both the high school level and the elementary level rather than simply focusing at the elementary level. The repealer on page 53 would repeal the alternative attendance adjustment, which is currently part of the integration revenue formula, and also would repeal the proficiency portion of the literacy incentive aid, which is replaced with the high school graduation aid component. Be happy to take questions on Article 2.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Representative McDonald, you're up.
Well,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This doesn't necessarily apply to Article 2, so is this still acceptable?
Proceed.
Very good. Doctor, I have a question. What is the governor's doing about any funding that we can get from the school trust lands? According to the Star and Tribune from over a year ago, the copper mines up in Ely and Babbitts could yield $2.5 billion for the school districts, and they believe it could swell for royalties of over 25 to 30 years. Okay. So has anything been done? I know the governor said in his State of the State speech that he wants to improve regulations and speed up businesses, the permitting process for businesses to get up and running. Has he addressed any of this precious lands, precious metals, and the school trust lands for our funding our education?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, a few years ago the legislature did do kind of the subtraction for the school trust fund lands. Originally, in the past, what had happened is that there was a per pupil amount each year that went out to students. That was basically, it never increased because it was just a subtraction. So a few years ago, what the legislature did is they bite off that subtraction. So as the value of the school trust lands increased, that's actually an increase that does go to school, that actually does go to schools when those lands increase in value. Last year, there was legislation that was put forward as a advisory group overseeing what is happening with the federal and state lands. In the swap between federal and state lands to make recommendations to the legislature. But as far as this bill goes, there isn't anything that actually changes how those school trust fund lands are managed, and that might be something we can check with the Department of Natural Resources if you'd like.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Yeah, right now the school trust lands, I think there is a $59 per pupil, which in smaller school districts account for thousands of dollars, and larger school districts, millions of dollars. So I would appreciate perhaps a little more data on that, and I think that because they were trust lands, those who set those lands aside trusted us, policymakers and lawmakers, to see to it that not only we are environmentally safe and sound and conservative, but also that we use those precious resources that the good Lord above put here to fund our schools and educate our kids. So I would hopefully expect that the Department of Education would really investigate that fully and tap those precious resources that are there in these very tough economic times, especially when the funding, we really don't know where it's all coming from. And I think it's a great area. And I know those, not only is it good for the schools, districts, but it's great for the state of Minnesota as well, and especially up in the Iron Range area.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are for Mr. McHenry. First, under educational excellence, the regional centers, I know we have three now. To what extent are those three aligned with our regional centers, such as we used to call our EXUs, and where will the other six be located to bring it to nine? Because this is growing government, this is going to be more cost incurred, and I want assurances that these really are going to serve the purpose of helping our schools. So could you comment on that, please?
Mr. McHenry?
Sure thing, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, currently the three regional centers that are under operation through the waiver, they work in conjunction with the service co-ops. So obviously the service co-ops provide services in a variety of administrative services. The regional centers are working more of a education-based and school-based. So I think the plan is that they will work in conjunction with the regional centers. They don't want to duplicate efforts. So I think kind of the plan that they've had moving forward is, rather than creating a new entity or rather creating a new building, they're working with areas with the regional centers if they can for where they can be housed and how they can work together with school districts and not duplicate efforts that are already being done by regional centers.
Mr. Chair.
Service co-op.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. McHenry. I'm glad to hear that. I would hope that we could look at these centers as being embedded in our regional service centers so that they have a greater connection with our school districts, because I do know that they do work closely with us right now. Mr. Chair, my next question for Mr. McHenry has to do with, what's the proof that increasing the English language learning from 5 to 7 years is going to bring us better results?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, that's a good question. There is research that we can get to you that suggests that as students that are learning English have more time in the classroom, that they'll have time to actually learn the language, and when they learn the language, they can perform better in the classroom. One of the things that we've been looking at is some of the information or some of the problems that English learners have if they're coming to Minnesota and they may not have a high level of education to begin with. Their parents may not have their native language completely formalized, that they might have more difficulty learning English. There's also the issue of poverty when new immigrants are coming to Minnesota that creates a problem that they could need more time. And as well as one of the other issues that's really big is some of our English learning population, they're very, they move quite a bit. And so when the population is more mobile, it's difficult for them to learn in any situation. If you look at students that are English speakers, they have difficult time when they're highly mobile. And then when you add in when they're trying to learn a new language, that makes it even more difficult. So I think the idea was by expanding it to 7 years, it would give more time specifically for those more in need. Obviously, there are parts of populations that may not need this full 7 years. And we can definitely work with you and work with the committee if you'd like to work on that as well.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. McHenry. I would hope to learn from the department the cost-benefit analysis between immersion and extending this to 7 years. Because we had this debate several years ago when we reduced the 12 years that were provided and did see some good research on immersion. So I would hope to look at that, and you can look forward to amendments galore from me on these issues. Final question is on the literacy incentive aid, Mr. Chair and Mr. McHenry. Including the graduation rate is going to take away, in my estimation, from the strength that we provided in the literacy programs that our districts have adopted and are using now, so that the focus is clearly on making sure that our children are ready to read when they enter fourth grade. So I just see this as being a watering down of some great legislation that Representative Myra, Senator Olson, and I worked on last year and the year before to really concentrate on that K-4 level. So why the change? I know I heard your rationale a few minutes ago, but to me, it seems like it is definitely a watering down.
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't think we view this as a watering down. We are still including, rather than having just third grade proficiency and third and fourth grade growth, we are having the growth in reading between third and fourth grade. The literacy plans districts still have to put together. And then by including graduation rates, this is something that we felt was important to help shine a light on our graduation rates and hold our schools accountable so they can actually do what they need to do to help increase our graduation rates.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Mr. McHenry, then we should design a literacy program for grades 5 through 12. That might be a better idea to shine the light on making sure that our students are reading as they proceed through grades four to graduation, reading at level and being proficient. That's where we should concentrate our effort. So I'll work on that idea.
All right. Well, and Mr. Chair, Representative
Ms. McHenry,
and as we had stated before, we're more than happy to work with you, work with the members on the committee here, for whoever would like to bring forward ideas. Again, this is what we felt was a good first step, and we look forward to any other ideas to help make this bill stronger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I actually have several long questions, and we're going to run out of time. And seeing as Representative McDonald brought the issue of the school trust fund, which is outside of Article 2, but we put it on the table here, I'm wondering if I could yield to my colleague, Representative Ansels, who wanted to comment on it.
Representative Ansels.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mariani, that might be a little dangerous that you did that. But quite frankly, members, the governor and other committees of the legislature are diligently working on the issue of potential wealth from school trust land development. Some would characterize it as exploitation. It's complicated. It certainly is not within the purview, I would say, of this committee. And also, I believe it's closer to the figure of about $30 per pupil that the people of northeastern Minnesota, where 95% of the school trust fund lands are sharing with school districts statewide. So let's try to avoid complicating the school trust fund land development issues in this committee.
Mr. McHenry, Dr. Melcher, would you care to comment on that? All right. back to Representative Mariani, if you care to.
I thought that was going to take longer than I. Thank you, Representative Ansels. Very quickly on the integration levy issue, and I'll visit with you some more on this, but seeing as the levy is set to sunset, is the language here meant to help fill in whatever hole is created once that's sunsetted with state aid?
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Melcher,
Representative Mariani, no. What this does is it creates a kind of a fully funded integration formula in 2014 based on the current funding level. And then in 2015, it just ratchets it all down by 30% because the integration levy has sunset. So basically, school districts would all be getting 70% of what they would be getting under the new formula in 20. So that this budget does not address the issue of that gap.
Okay, this
Representative Mariani.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. So unless we act. In essence, the proposal before us defunds a portion of the law's commitment to providing resources for integration program efforts. And members, I would urge great caution in this. I'm mindful of what I said, Mr. Chair, earlier about once you start pulling out one piece, you know, the whole logic, you know, of the proposal begins to diminish a bit. excuse me, but I think we need to nonetheless move pretty carefully here. If we're on the verge of creating some pretty effective strategies, as we've heard in our committee, my committee last week, on the newly evolved role of integration revenue as a tool to help drive both interracial integration and academic achievement. For the sake of sort of this broader logic here, we might be sacrificing that by virtue of having less resources available for schools to be able to continue with that work, which is the hope of the task force that we, in fact, do continue making those kind of investments. So we'll have to have a good discussion and continue exploring a different way, perhaps a different way to do this.
And with that, are there any final comments by Representative Chair Marquardt?
So, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for the questions and the comments. And my chair, Mr. Chair, my wish would be to Thursday come back, and if Dr. Melcher and Mr. McHenry then would finish up the remaining articles of the bill, and then we'll open it up for public testimony, further questions and comments at that point. And Representative Mariani makes a great point. I mean, one of the focuses of this committee is achievement and closing the achievement gap and all those things, and you know, that's why we need to wrap all of these things around that. So I mean, the governor's proposal here and others that will come forward certainly needs to be part of this goal of, you know, how do we measure things, how do we make things more accountable, how do we use them as tools to close the achievement gap and raise performance. Also, I think Commissioner Caselius will be here also on Thursday. She had a school visit today, I believe, and could not be here, but she'll provide some comments to open up probably on Thursday if she's available. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. And with that, just an announcement for members, please place the bill in your save folder for work on Thursday. And remember that tonight we'll have a joint meeting at 6 p.m. in room 200. There will be no meeting tomorrow morning. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
I mean, Johnson.